Welcome to Book Talk. This is Alan Farley, and this week it's all about Jack London. Stay tuned. With me today is Paul Malmont, here with his book, Jack London in Paradise, a novel. Welcome to KALW.
Thank you. Thank you.
A novel about Jack London.
Yeah.
So it's got a lot of real characters in it.
Right. As Jack London, obviously, is the main character. Charmian London, his wife, is a big part of it. And then there's a little-known but very real person by the name of Hobart Bosworth. Little-known today, but at the time, he was a very famous Hollywood actor and director.
When I started reading, I thought, well, now, is this a made-up name?
It's a great name.
And I thought, I had to finally look it up. It really is.
Yep. He was a real person. Probably, one of his claims to fame is that he may have been the first person to actually make movies in California, brought his crew out here and started shooting. His studio, Hobart Bosworth Productions, made several Jack London pictures in partnership with Jack London, and the schism between the two about that, which is based in fact, is part of what sets the story in motion.
Well, he made hundreds of films. Of course,
yeah,
he started
really
in the silent era.
Yeah, an interesting thing about him is that, you know, when I was writing the book, I said, well, I want to see some of these Jack London movies that he made, right? And that's going to tell me a lot. Couldn't find any. They're gone. You know, like so many early movies that we're talking 1912, 1913, 1914, they're gone, lost the ages. I found one print at the Library in Congress of Martin Eden, which was an adaptation of a Jack London novel. And so I went down to Washington and I booked my time and, you know, went to the Library of Congress, which was amazing. And they set it up for me. And there are two reels missing in this movie. And it was still amazing to see. You know, they had big crowd scenes and simulated locations. Hobart had come up here to Oakland, the Oakland area, to shoot it. So a lot of it was actually on location. So it was very interesting to be able to see what's going on. And then Jack London has an uncredited cameo as a drunken sailor at one point.
Well, I saw too that he had a role in The Sea Wolf.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah,
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
But what was it that attracted you to Jack London in the first place?
Well, a couple things. So I had been drinking in a bar with a friend of mine one night about 12 years ago, and he said, you should read John Barleycorn by Jack London. And I said, The Dog Rider? Because I had read White Fang and Call of the Wild, and that's what I assumed he was. And he said, oh, he's so much more than that. You know, he did all these amazing things. He sailed to Japan as a sealer, and he went to the Yukon, and he was an oyster thief and then an oyster policeman, and he marched across the country, and he rafted down the Mississippi, and he went to jail. And this is all before he turned 21.
Right.
And at a certain point, I was like, wow, I don't know Jack London the way I thought I did, the way everybody thinks they do. So I started looking into him, and I read John Barleycorn, which was, you know, probably the first drinking memoir that anybody had written. You know, he's very honest about his battle with the bottle, to the point at the end where he says, I'm not going to give it up. And then I started reading biographies of him and just found him just this incredible character. So he kind of sat in the back of my head for a long time. And then as I was working my first novel, which was about pulp magazine writers in the 1930s, also true people, I realized that the whole adventure pulp industry that had sprung up by the 1930s kind of started in response to the popularity of Jack London about two decades earlier. People wanted that. There was a real craving for it. So this industry sprang up, and all these writers who created Doc Savage and The Shadow and all these Western writers were all, they all owed a debt to Jack London. So I realized that writing about Jack was in some way kind of writing a prequel to my first book, though they're very different in style and tone. But it was all part of the same universe I discovered.
And why did you write, a novel about real people? And I mean, so you have to invent a lot of what they might have said to one another and things that they might have done.
Right. There's definitely a lot of the freedom to invent. the freedom to create a character who is based in facts and has these histories that you know about, but then there are gaps.
But you can fill in the gaps.
You can fill in the gaps, and it only works if you can find like conflict and mysteries. And I found conflict in the relationship he had with Hobart Bosworth, as these movies that they made got into trouble with copyright laws and other problems. And then I found three mysteries, which were what happened to the Wolf House, which was Jack's magnificent estate that he had been building in Glen Ellen. It burned down the night before they were supposed to move in, and it destroyed him financially. He never recovered from that, and they never really ascertained what happened. There are different theories. The second mystery of Jack London is, could he have fathered a son? He was very intent on having a boy heir, and there were rumors that in the last year of his life he had tried with another woman, not his wife, which obviously is another perfect conflict to explore. And then the third mystery was, how did he die? At first, when he died, the official report was uremia, which is a kidney failure. 30 years later, in a biography written by Irving Stone, who was a genius biographer, the truth came out that there had been an overdose of morphine. So there was that gap of 30 years before the truth came out, and then the truth, when it came out, was maybe not the entire truth of what happened, because it's hard to believe that Jack London would commit suicide or overdose. So there are some gray areas to play around with there. So
you started, I say you read a lot. Did you actually visit places?
I did.
A lot of this takes place in Hawaii, which is where he went and spent his last
right.
year.
It starts in briefly in Los Angeles, but then comes up here to Oakland, and we take a trip to Glen Ellen. And
Hobart Bosworth comes to the Palace Hotel.
That's right. Yes, the Palace Hotel, and you know, that was one of the places I came into, and I loved the painting in there, the Pied Piper, and I had to include that, and so I had to discover old menus from the Palace Hotel and see what they were serving at the time, and so you know, I explored some of Oakland. Then visited the state park and checked out that. And we spent some time, my family, my wife and two boys, we went to Hawaii and spent some time walking in Jack's shoes there. You know, it was only 100 years ago, and a lot of Hawaii has changed, but much like writing about New York in the 1930s, if you just look a little differently, if you squint or find old photographs to compare, you can see what it might have been like.
Why did he go to Hawaii?
He fell in love with the Pacific Islands in general in 1905, 1906, around then, when he built a boat called the Snark, and he took a very famous cruise, which he self-navigated across the Pacific with his wife, Charmian, and a couple other characters, and he wrote about it in the Journey of the Snark. And the boat ended up, you know, falling apart, and they ended up rootless in Australia, and Jack got sick, but they had visited Hawaii and spent a lot of time there on that voyage, and had met some wonderful people, and I think Jack was just really attracted to the spirit of the people, plus it wasn't as far as perhaps Tahiti or Fiji might have been, so the Matsonia steamship line was running regularly back then, so it was actually kind of easy to visit if you had the money to do it. You know, he became really good friends with Duke Kahanamoku, who was the legendary Olympian and the king of surfing. And Jack wrote about surfing, introduced America to the whole idea of surfing.
Wave sliding,
as they called it.
Yep. Yeah.
And he's one of the founders of the Waikiki, or the Honolulu Surf Club, which is still there. So in the last year of his life, he went there. Obviously, you know, he didn't know it was the last year of his life, but I think he was really kind of burnt out on the money he had lost here, and and just the pressures he was facing, and he always had to write to make a buck, even though he was, you know, on paper, it looked like everything was good, I think, and he wasn't feeling well. I think he just needed a change of scenery, so he got away from it all.
Yeah, you mentioned Duke Kahanamoko, and gosh, this dates me, but I remember back when Arthur Godfrey was doing radio and television shows, and he, I guess, spent time in Hawaii, because I think either Duke was on his program, or at least he talked about him in his program.
Mm-hmm.
That's where I first heard the name.
Oh, really?
And
that's great.
And then I'm thinking of the time frame involved, but this, because this, your novel takes place in, what's
1916.
16 is that,
right.
Is that last year?
Yeah, Duke
year.
Lasted a long time, though. He lasted easily into the 50s,
yeah.
You know, and he was the sheriff of Honolulu for decades. You know, he was an incredibly popular, charismatic man, and, you know, did a lot of great ambassadorship work on behalf of Hawaii.
Well, what did you find out about the relationship between Hobart Bosworth and Jack London? Was this all true about that that Bosworth followed him to Hawaii to try to to right their relationship, which had sort of gone sour?
Well, their relationship had gone sour, and the relationship had been poisoned by outside forces working against Hobart Bosworth in Hollywood, who wanted his studio, which would include the lots and the contracts that he had with talent and Hobart himself, by people who were trying to consolidate studios and create a bigger studio, which would ultimately become Paramount Pictures.
Yeah, Adolf Zukor was behind it.
Right, Adolf Zukor. Yes, that schism was there. I think what brought them together initially was that they had a lot in common in that both men, Hobart and London, were kind of self-made men who were not afraid of adventure. Both set out early, set out to sea, and boxed, and in other words, you know, answered the call of the wild, as it were. But as far as... did Hobart actually go to Hawaii? No, that's where the fiction begins.
Well, then I guess the when they get together and actually box,
yes,
is fiction too.
Figment of my imagination. But it would have been nice to see it for real. But at a certain point, I needed to. Of the two men, Jack certainly is the more famous, and he was in Hawaii, so there's a lot more of. Drawing from places that Jack actually was, corresponding to his wife Charmian's journals, and then I fit Hobart into that because there's a lot that's not known about Hobart and his, you know, not that he was, I'm sure that a Paramount Pictures historian would know exactly where he was by going to the archives, but as far as the public record goes, it's difficult to find out much about him, so I was able to say, okay, why not? He could have been there.
Oh, so you only got to see one of his films.
Right.
Because everything else is just disappeared?
Just gone. And then after the period that ends at the end of my book, he became a contract actor in Hollywood.
His studio was gone.
His studio was gone. But he acted for several decades on after that in, you know, Westerns, and became a very popular character actor, but never achieved what he set out to do.
Well, tell us some more about Jack London, because I really knew little of him. I knew the name. In fact, I've been to Glen Ellyn. I don't think that I visited the site of the
Wolf House.
The Wolf House.
Right.
But I certainly heard about it there.
That's worth seeing. It's amazing to see. It was practically a castle that he was building in this lodge style, and the stonework, the foundation work, was done so well that it still looks, you know, a lot like it must have soon after it burned down. It hasn't changed in you know, almost a century. Jack was an amazing person. You know, he's that American story of being self-made. He was born into incredible grinding poverty out here in a little south of San Francisco, and then his family moved to Oakland. He was a bastard child. The father was a traveling philosopher who would, you know, go to town and lecture people about how they about morals. But he wanted nothing to do with Jack's mother or Jack, so he disappeared. She married this man, John London, who was a Civil War veteran, and he took this family in and seemed like, for all intents and purposes, a really decent man, but never had much luck in business, and farms he tried to do would go out of business, different things. So they had a hand-to-mouth existence, and then I think he died when Jack was about 12, and Jack had to go to work. So he started off working in the salmon canneries here, and then shoveling coal, and was just exposed to, I mean, it's almost Dickensian when you think about the work that children had to do at that age and at that time. But he had this burning desire to improve himself and to learn. He realized that education was the key to getting him out of this life that he was living. So, and then the other side of him was every now and then he would stop what he was doing and he would go out on an adventure. So when he was 14 or 15, he signed on with a ship that sailed to Japan and went seal hunting, and then came back and went on several other sailing excursions, but always had to come back and support his mother and family. And then finally, the big opportunity was the trip to the Yukon during the Gold Rush. And he went there with three family friends, and as a young man, and he you know, again, was physically perfect for the trip. He they had the way to get into the Yukon was over the Chilkoot Pass. I don't know if I pronounced that right. I think I am. It was a mountain pass that, to be able to enter, you had to carry a ton of provisions for yourself into the Yukon, and you had to do it over this mountain. So he and his friends made 60 trips to get their supplies up so they could do it. Then they went to, they lived in a cabin through the winter where it was so cold that you spit and it would freeze in the air before it hit the ground. That might have been his embellishment, but it sure sounds great. Then they rafted back down to civilization at the end of the winter, and they had scurvy and, were just in horrible shape. But he came back and he had all these stories. And I think in that cabin, perhaps during the winter, he had realized that he could tell stories orally, that people were engaged with him. And I think that's when it might have occurred to him to start writing. And he decided to write about what he had lived and create these stories about men in ships and men in the Yukon, men against nature and man against man, in a way that had never been done before. You know, it was a very honest, streamlined take on these elemental stories, when the favor or the fashion at the time was Victorian melodrama. We were at the tail end of that Victorian era, and if it didn't take place in a drawing room, it wasn't considered dramatic. So he exploded when the Call of the Wild was published, and White Fang, people just went nuts. It was what they were craving without even knowing it. And he was 21, 22 years old when these books were published. And this didn't happen overnight, too. He wrote a tremendous amount before he was able to sell anything, just he would hawk his clothes, his bicycle, anything he had, rented a small apartment in Oakland, basically a room, not an apartment, and would write and write until he was exhausted and send them out, the stories, and because he just knew that sooner or later he would start to, if he wrote enough, he'd start to be paid for it, and if he could be paid for it, he could live and do it. And he managed to pull it off when there was no precedent for it. It was his idea to do it, and he was one of the first people to actually be able to create a living and fashion a living out of magazine writing specifically. And then when the novels became so successful, that too. But he realized that there was an industry that could support him in a living as a writer.
And his basic education was going to the library.
Yeah, he was self-taught. Now, the library that he went to here just happened to be run by, I think the person was a poet laureate of California, so...
Ultimately.
And was a good friend of Mark Twain or Samuel Clemens, so that talk about entering a library and it being opening you to a greater world you
right.
couldn't ask for. If you were thirsty for knowledge, here's somebody who really can expose you to what you need to be exposed to. But yeah, he followed his instincts about what he wanted to learn, and you know, there were a lot of, at that time, a lot of different crazy scientific theories about race and the brain and the heart and evolution and, you know, religion. And it must have been, you know, and a lot of it was not based in anything real. So it must have been a very interesting time to want to learn a lot of stuff. And he worked very hard to get into Berkeley. Even went back and finished high school when he would be, you know, the oldest person in the class. And then he was very disappointed when he got to Berkeley because he found it very entrenched and dogmatic. And I always thought that was so sad that after working for this for so hard for 2 or 3 years to get there, and then within a few weeks be so disappointed. It must have been a tough thing to recover from.
Oh, you mean to Cal, the University of California?
Yeah.
So. We're talking with Paul Malmont about his book, Jack London in Paradise. Well, tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got started, Rob.
Okay. I live in New York City. Well, actually, I've just moved to New Jersey for the first time. My family and I have moved out there to be closer to my kids' grandparents. But I've lived in New York for about 25 years prior to that, and I came to go to NYU Film School. And I thought I was going to be a filmmaker, and but I always wanted to write. I was going to be a writing filmmaker, or at least a screenwriter. But so I started working in New York film for about 10 years and worked on, you know, a bunch of bombs. I worked on Last Action Hero. I worked on Bonfire of the Vanities. I worked on Hudson Hawk. And you can learn a lot from being around failure. So, but I also got to work on some good movies. I got to work on The Fisher King, which I'm especially proud of. I just love that movie.
Oh, wait, what did you do?
I was a production assistant,
uh-huh.
location assistant. It's a good position to be able to be close enough to watch what's going on, it's good exposure for somebody who's young and interested in film. And I worked on The Doors, and I worked with Woody Allen's production company for a little while. I worked on a movie called Alice that he did. But I wasn't writing as much as I wanted to, and I wasn't writing professionally. So in the early 90s, when the dot-com era began, even prior to that, I started working in an interactive medium where the first job I had writing was a company that wanted to revolutionize the movies by putting buttons in your seat at the movie theater, and then the audience would choose the direction of the movie at certain points. And went about as well as you could expect it to. But like a lot of dot-coms, they raised a lot of money and uh-huh. they blew it. But I was writing for them. And then after that, I was able to get into a lot of marketing and new media consulting and that kind of thing. And that led to my current position as a copy director at a new media advertising agency. So, but as far as novel writing go, I had never written one before. I had done a short film about 10 years ago, and it was about magicians, and a fictional film, not a documentary. And in the course of this, I referenced an older magician, or actually not even a magician, but someone who wrote about magic. His name was Walter Gibson, and he created The Shadow. And along with Orson Welles, who portrayed The Shadow on the radio, who was also a magician.
The Shadow knows.
Yes, exactly.
What evil lurks in the minds of men.
And, you know, you can't talk about the history of radio without The Shadow. So I had these characters, and I started, you know, thinking about, yeah, I realized that I knew a lot about old New York and Walter Gibson and the pulps. I'd read pulps when I was younger, and I suddenly realized that I had this story to tell because I hadn't seen anything that told the story of the pulp world about The Shadow or about Doc Savage, that did it in a way that was new and relevant, that would explain to somebody who didn't know what the pulps were, why the pulps were so exciting, what impact the pulps had on the pop culture that we have now, like Superman and Batman are direct descendants of these other characters. So I didn't want to write a museum piece that were, you know, trying to create a new pulp hero for our age. I just wanted to tell a great story about these characters. And then when I found out that L. Ron Hubbard had been the science fiction writer, I knew he had to be in the story as well. And so I wrote that.
And that novel was?
The Chinatown Death Cloud Peril.
Chinatown Death Cloud Peril.
Rolls off the tongue, doesn't it? Yeah, it's not as easy to say as Jack London in Paradise. But, yeah, so that was a bestseller, and that definitely paved the way for this book. And
well, your first novel.
Yeah.
How'd you get it published?
Well, I did it the way you're supposed to.
Uh-huh.
I wrote the agents and sent out query letters and got 50 rejections, well, 49 rejections and one acceptance. And the person who took me on is a great agent who has a number of really exceptional writers, and I'm just proud to be in their company. And so, yeah, it was that story. I mean, the crazy thing that I discovered is that agents are really looking for you when it comes to writing. Like, they need to sell stuff to stay in business. So it's not like Hollywood, which is kind of a closed community, and they're very receptive to looking for people. So we worked on it together for a few more months, getting it in shape, and then she took it out, and we had a nice little auction, and Simon & Schuster came out the winner, and I've been with them ever since. So
now that Jack London in Paradise is out, I assume you've already been working on something else.
I have. I'm going back and doing the sequel to the first one, which takes place in 1943 as opposed to 1937. There's been a lot of people seem to really want a sequel to that first one, so I'm going to do that. And then I think I'm going to wrap up writing about fiction, you know, real people in fictional terms with one more book about the Richard Wagner's writing the Ring Cycle.
Oh.
And that'll wrap up.
Well, that sounds like a major project.
Yeah, that's going to be a big one. After that, I'm done with what I'm calling faction. And I'll just concentrate on totally original characters made up. But I'm kind of in this groove right now of exploring creativity in other people while I explore mine. So that's kind of a long-term plan.
Well, now, how does Wagner fit into this?
You know, I don't know how he does. I'll let you know when I get there. I just know that he does, and I think it'll be an interesting story. Because that's a major artistic accomplishment that took, you know, years to complete, and has all sorts of different significance for all sorts of different people around the world, good and bad. So, you know, kind of a meta-literary exploration of that, I think, is going to be a real interesting undertaking.
Well, I hope we can talk again when that one comes out.
I'll be more than happy to.
I've been talking with Paul Malmont, and his book is Jack London in Paradise. His novel is Jack London in Paradise. And it's published by Simon & Schuster. Book Talk is now available as a podcast. You can receive an MP3 of Book Talk every week free of charge for your MP3 player or home computer. Links to subscribe to all of KALW's local podcasts are available at kalw.org. And that's Book Talk for this week. This is Alan Farley. Thank you for listening.